work that the UN is performing in Gaza is quite literally life-saving. And no one else can do it. No one else is doing it. And it only underscores the importance of making sure that its facilities, including facilities that it's erected or is maintaining, that are housing the many, many displaced Palestinians until they can go back to their homes and neighborhoods, is essential, and it has to be protected.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a press conference today in Angola. He's talking about the UN shelter that was blasted with tank fire in southern Gaza yesterday, killing 12 people and injuring dozens more. Israeli officials say they're looking into who's responsible. So far, the Gaza Health Ministry says overall more than 25,000 Palestinians have been killed in this three-month war. Most of the 2 million people in Gaza have been displaced. Entire cities are now rubble. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing increasing pressure at home from the families of the 130 hostages still being held by Hamas. CIA Director Bill Burns is headed to Europe to help broker a hostage release deal. Joining me to discuss all this is Stephen A. Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Press Play.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's talk about this UN shelter building that was bombed. What happened? Do we have any more information on that?
We don't have any information about it. And I think that there's, as was the case early in the conflict with a strike on a Palestinian hospital, there's a lot of speculation about what's happened there. What we do know is that innocent people have been killed as a result, which is a terrible thing. And too many innocent people have been killed from the beginning of this conflict. This is starting on October 7th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's talk about efforts to at least have a pause in the fighting to perhaps secure the release of the hostages. Bill Burns, as I said, will be there. What can we expect from his presence? Why is the CIA director now getting involved in peace talks or in ceasefire talks, I should say, or a pause in fighting talks, more accurately?
Director Burns is someone who has long experience actually in the Middle East. He was the U.S. ambassador to Jordan. He's well known to all of the players. And he was intimately involved in the previous release of hostages, which happened in late November and December. There has been, as you indicated, pressure building on Prime Minister Netanyahu from the families of the hostages. In fact, the Israelis had offered a significant pause in the fighting in recent days that Hamas has rejected. And Burns is now going to Europe to meet with the Qataris, the Israelis, and the Egyptians to see if the requisite pressure can be brought to bear on Hamas, who had rejected the Israeli offer to a significant pause in the fighting to release hostages.
And if what anybody, was the Israeli offer?
A two-month pause in the fighting in order mm-hmm. to release the hostages that Hamas had rejected. If anybody can do this, it is Burns, mm-hmm. given his stature and given how well he works with all of the players. But of course, neither the Israelis nor Hamas are willing to actually have a real ceasefire, and thus this war will continue.
Right. And let's talk about this dust-up between Netanyahu and Qatar. In a meeting with the families of the hostages, Netanyahu was recorded as saying that the mediation, Qatar's role in that mediation was, quote-unquote, problematic. Why did he say that it was problematic that Qatar is involved in these talks when it has been a key player all along?
Well, the Qataris have played both ends of the fence here. They have Hamas in Doha. They have supported Hamas over the years. And that's why they have this role in the mediation, because they have relationships with Hamas. It's not because the Israelis, want the Qataris to be involved in it. It's because they really, besides the Egyptians, are the only ones in the Arab world who have that kind of role. But we should be clear that the Qataris themselves have turned the other way and looked the other way when it came to Hamas building out its military infrastructure in Gaza. The Qataris had a very senior diplomat posted in Gaza who was there to distribute reconstruction funds and aid funds to Gazans who are most in need. Hamas has absconded with that funding, and there are serious allegations that the Qataris were either knew what was happening or were even complicit in it. So whereas the Qataris have played a constructive role, at least in November, in securing the release of a good number of hostages, this doesn't mean that they are a non-problematic partner of either the United States or the Israelis. From the Qatari perspective, of course, they have maintained a principled position on the need for Palestinian justice and rights. If you look at Amir Tamim's statements, going back to last September's UN General Assembly meetings, he was very, very forceful on those issues. And the Qataris have been very, very forceful on these issues since the conflict began on October 7th with Hamas's massacre of Israelis.
Okay, so is there any optimism that there can actually be a pause in the fighting as brokered by the CIA director this time around? Do both sides perhaps seem a bit more willing or not to pause and have some kind of hostage prisoner swap?
Well, the Israelis, as I said, had made an offer a number of days ago that Hamas had rejected. I think that Hamas wanted too much from the Israelis, and it was it was thus a non-workable proposal.
Because they wanted to release all the Palestinian prisoners, is that right?
And the conditions that they wanted on, they do not want to have a temporary ceasefire. They want the end. And they want all Palestinian prisoners released. Their asking price is too much. Look, I think that Hamas is at the point where, one, they may not know how many hostages remain alive, because we know that Hamas is not the only ones who are keeping hostages. Two, this is their point of leverage. So it was always going to get harder and harder as you got down to fewer and fewer hostages. So, you know, as I said before, neither party is keenly interested in a permanent and durable ceasefire. They are quite far apart on terms of a temporary ceasefire for the hostage exchanges, which is why President Biden has dispatched the CIA director, who does have good relations with all of these leaders, to try to work out some sort of deal. I think it's healthy to remain skeptical that this is going to happen, because Hamas's demands are quite high. The Israelis do not want to bring the conflict to an end. They have vowed to destroy Hamas. That is a political imperative for any Israeli government. So at this point, it doesn't seem like we are whether there's a real end in sight.
Yeah, because without the hostages, Hamas has no leverage, right? So why would it be in Hamas's interest to give back the hostages if Israel doesn't promise an end to the war?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that that's the argument that prior to this offer on the part of the Israelis that Prime Minister Netanyahu and others within the Israeli government have been making, which is that the only thing that's going to release the hostages is military pressure. But that Israelis have brought an enormous amount of force to bear on the Gaza Strip, as you outlined. You know, excess of 25,000 dead, entire cities reduced to rubble, people in desperate situations, yet Hamas continues to hold on to 139 Israelis. So something is going to have to give, but it strikes me that neither Hamas nor the Israelis have actually, and this is going to sound shocking, have been bloodied enough. That this phase of the conflict has not been, as diplomats would say, ripened enough that make it a propitious moment for negotiations for either hostages or actually negotiations to end this conflict.
And very quickly, we have just a few seconds. What about all of the, I guess it's a million plus Gazans now crowded into the southern part, just near the Rafah border?
This is unimaginable misery. Tens of thousands of people have lost their lives, children who are orphans, parents without their children, food hard to come by, medical care scarce. This is a catastrophe of extraordinary proportions. There's no other way to put it.
Stephen A. Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, highlights from the Sundance Film Festival, including a film about Will Ferrell and his close friend, who recently came out as a trans woman, on a road trip together. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Sundance, it's more than just lounges, sponsored by Chase and Grey Goose Vodka. Independent films get screened there, too. Some will emerge with that all-important buzz that can propel a no-name filmmaker to greater fame. Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of the book This Is How You Make a Movie. He was there at Sundance looking at those no-name future famous filmmakers. Hello.
Hello there. I didn't have any Grey Goose vodka while I was there.
I have to
tell you. None. That it was not available at any of the screenings I went to, sadly.
I think White Claw was the big sponsor this year. But anyway, themes of this year, of 2024 Sundance, anything emerge?
This year, several of the movies I saw at the festival were really good, but they were accentuated by the fact that you got to see them in packed houses. That I had that experience last year with Past Lives, which premiered at Sundance and, of course, just got nominated for Best Picture. And there are a couple of movies this year that I saw where the actual audience experience, like collectively watching these things and sort of discovering these movies, added to the impact of actually watching the films.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into some of your favorites. One of them you brought us is A Real Pain. It stars and is written and directed by Jesse Eisenberg, also stars Kieran Culkin. And they are two cousins who travel to Poland after their grandmother dies. Tell us a little bit more.
You wouldn't think that sounds like a comedy, maybe necessarily, but it is. It's a really great comedy drama. Eisenberg and Culkin play cousins who basically grew up together. They're basically brothers, and they haven't seen each other in a while. They're both traveling to Warsaw to honor their grandmother, who passed recently. And in her will, she basically gave them a trip to Warsaw so they could essentially revisit the family roots. She is a Holocaust survivor. And the film is this really moving study of these two cousins who are very close and yet very, very different in so many ways. And remarkably, not only is the movie really funny, but it actually sort of talks about the shadow of the Holocaust for Jewish families in like contemporary America. And as part of this tour, they're going to go visit a concentration camp. And for a movie about two cousins, it's pretty funny. It's also like surprisingly emotional. It doesn't feel manipulative. They actually go to a concentration camp. It feels like basically woven into the story about guilt and survival and forgiveness. I think it has a really decent chance of actually winning the grand prize.
Oh, wow. And so will we be able to see it then?
Yes. It actually got picked up by Searchlight Pictures during the festival. It got a standing ovation at its premiere. I think Culkin, who, of course, just won the Emmy for Succession, he is going to be, I think, a serious awards contender for his performance. They're both really great in it, but Culkin is especially fantastic.
Okay, that's A Real Pain. You also loved A Different Man, and this stars Sebastian Stan. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so Sebastian Stan plays a struggling actor in New York who has a severe facial disfigurement, figuring that that is the reason why he is not successful both in his career and in love. He volunteers for this experimental procedure. It works, and he ends up looking like Sebastian Stan. But something very weird happens, which is that this woman that he had become friends with, who is an aspiring playwright, he disappears essentially. She makes a play about him before he'd had this like experimental surgery. And an actor played by Adam Pearson is going to play him in the play. If people remember the movie Under the Skin, the movie with Scarlett Johansson, one of the men that she does bad things to in that movie, one of the actors that she picked up was an actor named Adam Pearson. He's a British actor who has an actual facial disfigurement, but he's an actor. He is in this movie. He is absolutely terrific. Adam Pearson is great. Sebastian Stan is great. It's a really, really sharp, smart comedy.
Oh, wow. Okay. That looks good too. A Different Man coming out, I guess, sometime this year, from A24. Moving on to a documentary. This one is called Girl State, and I guess it's a follow-up to Boys State from the same filmmakers. And that one was about an annual assembly of high school boys who create their own mock government. So I guess this is the girls' version. How did they fare, and how did they run the world differently?
The original Boys State was done in Texas. That movie, this one is in Missouri, and it follows a group of girls in Missouri over 1 week to form Girl State. The idea, like with Boys State, is that they're going to form their own kind of mock government where they run for different political offices. And what's interesting, though, is that at this Girl State, Boys State is happening simultaneously on the same campus. We're watching primarily Girl State, but the girls at Girl State keep noticing it seems like Boys State actually has more funding and they get actually like a access to more stuff than we do. And why is that?
They get more Academy Award nominations
They get
than
more
we
K
do.
word. Yeah, it's a really interesting movie. It's fascinating to see, for instance, the girls' Supreme Court that is formed. They form like a circle before they're going to go on stage to their first time as Supreme Court justices. And they're doing affirmations like, it is okay if I make a mistake. It is okay for me to be strong. There was nothing like that in Boys State. And by watching both movies, you notice at that young age how boys and girls learn different ways about how they're supposed to behave.
Okay, Girl State, and where can we see this and when?
It's going to be coming out on Apple TV. They have not announced a date yet.
All right. Here is another movie. This one we actually have a clip for from the trailer, so I assume that it has already been sold. It's called Love Lies Bleeding. It stars Kristen Stewart, Katie O'Brien, and Ed Harris.
FBI, open up.
Are you threatening me?
Yep.
That was really stupid, honey.
Okay, so it sounds like a lot of gunfire there. Is this a caper film? What's going on?
It's a bit of a caper film. This will be coming out also through A24 in March. It is set in the late 1980s in a small kind of seedy town in New Mexico. And it does star Kristen Stewart and Katie O'Brien as new lovers who, through plot complications I don't want to reveal, get into a bit of trouble with the law. And Ed Harris plays Kristen Stewart's father. He is a bad dude, and it is a violent, sexy, erotic thriller. It's the kind of fun future cult movie that I think you're either going to embrace or dislike completely. It got divisive reviews out of Sundance, but I have to say, I was at the premiere and the audience went pretty nuts for it. If you like your kind of thrillers to be kind of kinky and weird and take big swings and be sort of like, what the heck at certain points, Love Lies Bleeding may be right up your alley.
Okay, Love Lies Bleeding, which we'll be able to see in March. Next up, a film that got a lot of buzz, Will and Harper. And this is a documentary about Will Ferrell and his friend, his longtime friend, SNL head writer Harper Steele, who has transitioned to be a woman. So tell us about that one.
Harper always loved to do road trips across America. That's one of the things she's always loved to do. But now that she has come out as a trans woman, she's a little nervous about going to like the seedy bars and kind of like out of the way places that she was able to before. She's nervous about how she would be received in these worlds. And so they decide to go on a road trip together to find out and also kind of reassess their friendship after this kind of major news. And so essentially, a camera crew follows Will and Harper from the East Coast all the way to Los Angeles as they stop in a bunch of places. And obviously, Will Ferrell is a very, very famous person. And so Will is trying to be kind of an ambassador for his friend. My one kind of big reservation about the movie is that it's hard sometimes because it sometimes feels nothing's manufactured. I believe everything that we see in the movie is sincere, but having a camera crew follow them as they're going on this sort of real journey, but also this like personal journey between these two old friends, the camera sometimes can get in the way of that. I don't think the documentary is great, but I will say this. I think a lot of people, this may be their first kind of encounter with someone from the trans community. And it's a really sort of beautiful story. And I think it's going to help a lot of people feel more seen. And so I think the movie has a lot of value because of that.
Okay, the movie's called Will and Harper. And finally, I saw the TV Glow. That also is getting some buzz. This is a movie about a TV show getting canceled. And from the description, it seems like it might be a long Black Mirror episode. What do you think?
It's the new film from writer-director Jane Schoenbrunn. That was sort of a creepy psychological horror movie. I saw the TV Glow is kind of in the same realm. It's about two high school classmates who become friends because the woman introduces the guy to this like really weird, quirky show. Basically, it's like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. If you watch the movie and watch the show within the movie, you're like, oh, this is like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There's some references to Buffy. And the show bonds these two teenagers who don't have a lot in common other than both of them being outcasts. When the show goes away, when it's canceled, the young woman vanishes as well. And the main character, this guy played by Justice Smith, who's been in Dungeons and Dragons and other stuff and is really good, wonders what happened to his friend. It's a movie that is more sort of emotional and visceral as opposed to being a tightly plotted affair. Kind of like a David Lynch movie, there is almost a dreamlike logic. This is going to be also coming out through A24. It's a movie that is kind of transporting and kind of funky and does its own thing. And it really shows that Schoenbrunn is, a very kind of singular artist doing their own thing. This movie is not going to be for everybody. There are parts that I don't think are as strong as other parts, but this is a vision. And one of the great things about a festival like Sundance is getting to see new visions and just be like, they're definitely going places.
Well, that sounds great. Well, a bunch of great movies.
Yeah, if it's not clear, I'm in a very good mood right now after being here for a week. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on the show today and sharing your good cheer with us.
My pleasure.
Tim Gerson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of the book, This Is How You Make a Movie. Coming up, movies you can see now.
I laughed out loud several times in this movie at times that I was not supposed to. It's kind of an embarrassment for all involved.
Your weekend film reviews are next on Press Play.
You
You're listening to 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's time for film reviews. And this week we have a couple of international features. We have a student teacher semi-erotic thriller and a raucous political satire. With me to discuss are Christy Lemire and Alonzo Duralde. They both co-host the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. Hello, you two.
Hello.
Hi.
I would like to eat breakfast all day.
Right.
As a matter of fact.
It's delicious.
It's delicious. Waffles, please. Okay, first up, Miller's Girl. This stars Martin Freeman as a teacher and Jenna Ortega as his gifted student.
I want you to write a short story in the style of your favorite author.
Are you offering me a special treatment, Mr. Miller?
Well, John here is prepping her to be his transcendent.
Is she pretty?
Oh, she's talented.
Damn, even worse.
What are you bragging about?
I'm uninspired.
I've had no achievement. Make him love you.
All right, Christy, Jenna Ortega's character lives in a small Tennessee town. Her parents are pretty much absent, and her literature teacher is a failed novelist who is having some problems with his marriage. And, well, they begin to pay special attention to each other. So tell us more.
Didn't we learn anything from Nabokov? I mean, everyone's got this like literary
seriously
background here. No one ever says that word, and it's so obvious as to what's going on here. It's such a cliche. So Jenna Ortega is this wise beyond her years, brilliant, tragic, Southern Gothic 18-year-old named Cairo Sweet. But because we are in Tennessee, everyone calls her Cairo. Cairo. And so she's brilliant, and she's a senior in high school, and she takes this creative writing class from Martin Freeman's character. He is the titular Miller. He is one of the two Millers who are important here.
Henry Miller being the other.
Exactly. And so there is a flirtation, and they see something in each other, and it's wrong, and they both know it, and it's where it goes from there. This has some things going for it. You know, the language is heightened in a way that I think a lot of other high school movies have done it better, particularly Heathers and Thoroughbreds, you know, like wealthy, beautiful people who are, you know, speaking in a way more articulate way than anybody possibly could at this age. And that can be a little exciting at first, but it becomes just kind of pummeling and incessant. And as likable as Jenna Ortega is here, and in general, she's kind of doing a Wednesday Addams thing where she's like mean and spiky and very self-aware, but also kind of beguiling at the same time. I really like Dagmara Domancic as Martin Freeman's wife, who is kind of a cliche, like blousy, drunk, Southern, you know, voluptuous, just kind of drunk all day and emasculating, but she brings something kind of alluring to that. And I liked Bashir Salahuddin as a fellow teacher at the school. But it all feels really inevitable. It all feels kind of pointless and like an empty exercise.
Right. And we have, as you said, we have seen this plot many, many times. Alonzo, what did you think?
I think Chrissy's being kind here. heightened is barely to touch upon the insane amount of like overripe cliches and ludicrous, this is how writers talk dialogue. There's almost no conversation in this movie that sounds like it would be transpiring between two human beings. And that is not the fault of the cast, who are all like committed to the bit and giving it their all. I also liked Bashir Salahuddin. I'm a huge fan of Dagmara Domancic, but she is saddled with a character who is ludicrously like inconsistent from scene to scene, and ultimately just this sort of collection of nagging wife cliches. I laughed out loud several times in this movie at times that I was not supposed to. It's kind of an embarrassment for all involved.
Ooh, wow. And this is writer-director Jade Bartlett's debut. And
It can only go up from here.
I guess so. Silver lining. All right, Miller's Girl in theaters and wide release beginning today. Next up, we have a film called Totem. This is about a 7-year-old girl who's at her grandfather's house for the day waiting for her dad's birthday party to begin.
El sol que brilla. Y aunque sea un sol de mediodía, no teme a la decadencia.
Okay, so guy's making a toast there. He's saying there is a sun that shines and though it may be the midday sun, it does not fear its decline. Alonso, this was Mexico's Oscars submission for Best International Film. It did not make the final list, but there have been some good reviews of this. What did you think?
Yeah, so this is from writer-director Lila Aviles. She previously did the acclaimed film The Chambermaid, and this one also has a very strong sort of sense of place and mood and rhythm. As you say, Sol is a young girl. The whole movie pretty much it takes place on one day. There's a party that is being thrown for her father, who is terminally ill, is battling a cancer diagnosis. We see a lot of aunts and uncles and grandfather in and out of this house, which is a big, beautiful house that has clearly seen better days. And as the day proceeds, we come to understand that the family is maybe not as financially secure as it once was, although they still sort of live like they are. It brings to mind the early films of a director like Lucrecia Martel, a movie like La Cienaga, where you've got people just all in this house interacting with each other and on top of each other, and other dramas unfold along the way. And it's also sort of like if in the movie Roma, if the whole thing were the that holiday party sequence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's very canny. Aviles is very sharp at giving us character detail and backstory and all these things without ever making it obvious that that's what she's doing. But in the course of the action of this film and through the eyes of this child, we get to know this family and understand, you know, what's great about them, what's terrible about them, and sort of what lies ahead for them in their future.
So you loved it, liked it.
I find it very, it definitely draws you in. I think it's a film where that I think that sometimes it makes its points more than once. But nonetheless, I because you are given sort of scant clues along the way that you have to be paying attention to, it is a movie that commands your attention.
All right, Christy, what did you think?
I liked it and didn't love it, too. I really liked the sense of place, because you do feel like you are immersed in the rhythms of this house and this family. Alonso, I was thinking about you while I was watching it, because it is this big family, you know, this big boisterous family and you know, all coming in and out, and there's a lot of love and cooking, and I just thought maybe that you might have responded to that. But it's a lovely film, and it could have been really mawkish given what it is happening at this party, given what this party is about. And I thought that being through the eyes of this little girl who's played by Naima Sentias sort of helps to soften that a bit, you know, so it's not heavy-handed and it's not, you know, emotionally walloping at all. And so, yeah, you do sort of feel a gradual sense of melancholy as the day is going on. Like there's bustling and there's preparations and sort of an undercurrent of tension the whole time, because we know something is off here. This isn't a totally celebratory occasion. But then, you know, when the actual party happens, there's a sense of catharsis and a sense of real great emotional release. So I did like it quite a bit.
Okay. Totem in select theaters tomorrow. It opens in Los Angeles on February 2nd. Next up, we have The Breaking Ice, written and directed by Anthony Chen. This follows three melancholy 20-somethings whose paths cross in a Chinese city on the border of North Korea. Okay, the dialogue there between two young men and a young woman. One of them asks her to have dinner. The other tells her he doesn't want to be alone, and she tells him to come over. Alonso, this gave me a little bit of a Jules and Jim vibe.
Yeah, no, it's hard not to think about Jules and Jim when you're looking at a love triangle that is, you know, a resolutely heterosexual one. But yes, you have a woman, Nana, played by Dong Yuzhu, who works as a tour guide in a fairly remote area of China that's near the border with North Korea. And she has a sort of on-again, off-again relationship with a local restaurateur who is played by Xu Xiaoqiu, And a visiting finance worker from Shanghai who's there for a wedding and is clearly deeply depressed, played by Haoran Liu, goes on her tour and then winds up sort of hanging out with the two of them. And we see a definite kind of emotional interplay work itself out where both men are clearly interested in her. And they've all got burdens of the past to deal with. A restaurateur never left the town. She was once a promising athlete who walked away from it. The guy from Shanghai clearly thought that working hard and succeeding in school and moving away from, you know, his small town was going to bring him fulfillment and happiness. And so none of them are at a place right now where they really like their lives. But maybe by the end of their encounter, they'll move to a place where they do.
All right. Christy, what did you think?
I like this a lot. And so much of that has to do with the mood, as Alonzo says. It really puts you in this sense of kind of like melancholy, wistful isolation. Anthony Chen wrote this film during the pandemic, during like isolation in a hotel room during COVID. And I think you get that sense of feeling kind of alone and kind of introspective and kind of in flux. You know, all three of these characters are, they're all running from something or towards something. But for this brief moment in time, for all three of them, they become this kind of makeshift family that feels really authentic and true. Yeah, the score also, I think, does a lot to create that sense of mood as far as being kind of synthy and kind of chilly. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of envelops it all in a sense of kind of mystery, but also possibility. So I liked it a lot. They accomplished quite a bit visually here and also tonally.
Okay, cool. The Breaking Ice, or Cold, is at the Lemley Royal beginning tomorrow. Finally, we have a satire called The Sweet East. It stars Talia Ryder, Jacob Elordi, and Simon Rex. Ryder's character, Lillian, is a lost high school senior from South Carolina who is gallivanting across the eastern seaboard.
I don't think she'd be scared. I think she's really braver than you think.
The election was a pre-scripted puppet show, just like every year.
I need to know what's going on down in that basement now.
What in your young life could you have encountered to inspire you?
I don't know. I never really cared about that stuff.
All right, Christy, what is going on here? There seems to be yet another Lolita moment in this movie as well.
Kinda. I kind of think this character is more like a super micro indie version of Emma Stone in Poor Things.
Oh,
because she's kind of going on this journey, and like every man she meets is trying to shape her, and she's also taking pieces of each person that she meets along the way, and that helps like inform who she's going to pretend to be in the next scenario. So It is not at all at the level of Poor Things in any way in terms of technically or the cohesion of the writing or anything. But it kind of gave me that same vibe of like, here's a young woman on a journey of discovery, trying to figure out who she is in the midst of the patriarchy. But it's ultimately kind of episodic. You know, Talia Ryder is a high school student who just kind of bails on her school's trip to Washington. They're from South Carolina, and she just kind of takes off and goes off with one person, and then she meets Simon Rex and goes off with him for a while. And that is, I think, the strongest section of them all. It's the longest and it feels the most developed, and Simon Rex is just great in it. It's a character that you think you know, and there's maybe more interesting stuff going on with him than you first expect. It drags here and there. And ultimately, I don't know what the point is. I mean, maybe it's just the journey is the destination, but I don't know that she's necessarily any different at the end than she was at the beginning. But maybe that's the point, too.
Alonzo, this was written by a film critic named Nick Pinkerton.
Yes.
So a colleague of yours, I guess.
He's a great film critic. I'm a big admirer of his writing, he's done some Blu-ray commentaries that I think are really great. This movie is, it's a bit of a Shaggy Dog story. It's a picaresque. So, it is this sort of episodic thing where she kind of wanders from place to place and person to person. And I think the strongest aspect of it is the fact that is Talia Ryder's performance, but also the way that the script has her basically, magpieing different people's experiences and incorporating them into herself as she is, faking it until she makes it, although she never quite makes it. So, you know, you can sense that Pinkerton is trying to throw his arms around a lot of contemporary issues, whether it's about neo-Nazis or about sort of befuddled indie filmmakers or religious fundamentalism. And you can see the ideas there and sort of look at them and go, oh, that's the idea. But it doesn't really quite incorporate itself into the story as strongly as it might have. So, yeah, it's a bit rambling, but you have some charming bits along the way. I agree with Christy that the Simon Rex segment is probably the strongest one. Newly minted Emmy winner Io Edebiri turns up as an indie filmmaker. But yeah, it's a bit of a shambles.
A bit of a shambles. Okay. The Sweet East opens at Landmark's New Art Theater tomorrow, and it's in some other select theaters. Well, thank you both. That was not a shambles. That was a really good segment, so thank you.
We are very coherent.
You are.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Christy Lemire and Alonzo Duralde co-host the YouTube channel Breakfast All Day. Coming up, what it means that University of Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh will coach the Chargers and who will win this weekend's NFL playoffs. The Sklar brothers are here to talk sports next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
The San Francisco 49ers are California's last best hope to send a team to the Super Bowl this year. They host the Detroit Lions this Sunday in the NFC Championship game. The Kansas City Chiefs, led by star quarterback Patrick Mahomes and Taylor Swift's boyfriend, sometimes known as Travis Kelce, are in the AFC title game again, 6 years in a row now. They will play the Baltimore Ravens, led by longtime head coach John Harbaugh. John's baby brother, Jim, fresh off his national championship at the University of Michigan, is the new head coach of the LA Chargers. It is a big sports weekend. We're going to talk about it all with two more Wolverine alums who traded snowy Ann Arbor for sunny Los Angeles. My favorite pair of brothers, the Sklars, Randy and Jason, host of the podcast View from the Cheap Seats. Hi, you guys.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
Okay. I'm great. You must be ecstatic about the Harbaugh news.
Yes, we are. I mean, we're a little sad, as Randy was saying. It's bittersweet. Obviously, we wanted Jim Harbaugh to stay and win multiple national championships at our alma mater, University of Michigan. But Charger fans, LA Charger fans, it's time to rejoice. You have a guy who is coming in, not just trying to win by analytics. He's coming in and trying to create a culture, which is what he did at Michigan. He came in at a time where Michigan was not willing to pay players under the table, where they were all about trying to evaluate talent and get these under-the-radar guys and get people to buy in and play a certain brand of football that is tough, that is hard-nosed, that is just like Jim Harbaugh. And I think that recipe will be great for the Chargers, an organization that has lived in the shadow in Southern California of the Rams. And I think if you're a Chargers fan, it is a good time to put stock in that team because Jim Harbaugh is a great add to Southern California.
Right. Okay. So let us turn to a Michigan team that hasn't seen much playoff success this century or even in the last century, and that is the Detroit Lions. They play the 49ers in Santa Clara on Sunday, and the last time I understand they won a playoff game on the road was in San Francisco against the Niners, but that was during the Eisenhower administration. So are they going to end this Cold War era streak?
I know. Well, you know, it's interesting that Jay brings up like the culture that is created because there's been a huge trend in the National Football League to hire like the hotshot young guy who is kind of a whiz kid offensive, like a guy who plays video game offenses and is really a smart guy. The Lions went in the other direction and hired this guy, Dan Campbell, who is a former tight end in the NFL, who in his opening press conference just fresh off the Lions losing all 16 games, 0-16 in one season, like a couple years removed from that, he said, we're going to come in and change the culture here, and we're going to bite people in the kneecaps, I believe was his exact quote. Nah, he's not really doing that, but he wanted to build a team that was as tough as him. And again, not to relate it to Harbaugh, that's the type of teams that Harbaugh created at Stanford and created at Michigan and created with the 49ers when he took them on a run years ago. So it is kind of a little bit against the grain, but you're seeing the Detroit Lions have success. And everyone in Detroit, you got to remember, going to Michigan, we have a lot of friends from Detroit. This is like the greatest month of football ever for those people. Michigan wins the national championship. Detroit wins its first playoff game since 1991. And then they win another one and go to the NFC championship. This is great times. They feel like they're playing with house money. It's going to be a great game.
Okay, here's Dan Campbell last week, right after they beat Tampa Bay.
And it's harsh winters, right? Auto industry, blue collar. Things aren't always easy. They're kind of salty. You know, they don't quit. They play hard. And so I feel like we've done that.
Okay, so I guess they're the underdogs. And so is anyone outside the Bay Area rooting for the Niners?
The rest of the country is, right? I feel like, right, Jay?
Well, I don't think the rest of it. I think she's saying, is anyone rooting for the Niners outside of the Bay Area? I think most people are rooting for the Lions outside of the Bay Area. Yeah, I mean, there is an underdog feel, though, with the Niners quarterback, Brock Purdy, who was labeled Mr. Irrelevant, the last player drafted in his draft. And talk about a guy, he came from Iowa State University, wasn't a highly regarded pick, but he worked his way up past guys that were drafted much higher than him. And he has become a great quarterback for the 49ers. He, in his own right, is sort of this underdog story that makes even the 49ers, I know it's hard to say that, a San Francisco team here in L.A., it makes them even a little likable. I don't even know if I can say that on a LA radio show.
Okay, but I mean, even though unlikable, do you expect them to win?
I think the 49ers are a 7-point favorite in Vegas odds, and that's about, you know, they are playing at home. Home kind of gives you about a 3-point cushion in general. And in the other game, just for reference, Baltimore is widely considered the favorite in that Baltimore-Kansas City matchup, and they're only 4-point favorites, which, if you know anything about Patrick Mahomes, he's been to this game 6 times. He's been to the Super Bowl 4 times. I mean, he's 3 times, 1-2. He's an amazing quarterback, and so anything can happen. A 4-point swing is not that much. I think, you know, Detroit has to play the way the Packers played against the 49ers in the first 3 quarters of that game last week, and they may have a shot. And again, they just have to play a different style. Like, San Francisco has so many offensive weapons. They've got Christian McCaffrey, who's like a all-purpose kind of Swiss Army knife running back. They got Debo Samuel, even though he's a little banged up. They have a great tight end in George Kittle and Brandon Ayuk as a wide receiver. So a lot of offensive weapons, but if they don't get going, you're going to see a dogfight. And again, like you played that clip with Dan Campbell, who do you want in a dogfight? A guy who identifies with United Auto Workers or, you know, someone up in San Francisco?
Okay. I'm going to go against the grain and go for root for San Francisco. The underdog, okay. Underdogs. All right. On the other side, who do you have?
Go ahead, Jay.
Go, Rand. Go ahead, Roddy.
Okay, so I think the Baltimore Ravens just have, again, they've got a special quarterback who will probably be the MVP of the league. His name is Lamar Jackson. Came from Louisville. Unbelievable athlete. Great arm. But what happens is, you know, the defense of the Kansas City Chiefs, which really won that game up in Buffalo last week, they put the clamps down on Buffalo, and a great quarterback. They could do everything right, cover all the receivers, make sure that everything's covered, and then Lamar Jackson is just this guy with tremendous speed, tremendous athleticism, who can escape the pocket and run for 15, 20 yards when a play breaks down, and that is just the heartbreaker. You know, you got a team down at third and long, you have a chance to get off the field, and then you do everything right as a defense, and this guy is the guy to break the defense. So I think it's going to be hard to beat them. They're at home in Baltimore. Baltimore's defense is really one of the best, an elite defense. And I think John Harbaugh, to get back to the Harbaugh of it all, John Harbaugh won a Super Bowl against his brother, Jim Harbaugh, years ago. And I believe that, you know, going to the mountaintop, so to speak, gives you that experience to keep your team calm in situations. And I would give, you know, Andy Reid's won a Super Bowl II with Kansas City, so you're paying like two guys who have great experience. But I don't know. I just something special about the Harbaughs this year. I really, okay. You might have a Harbaugh national champion and Harbaugh Super Bowl winner.
All right. You heard it here first. Maybe not first, but best. Randy and Jason Sklar, check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Nihar Patel, and Bennett Purser. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. And our technical director is, of course, Super Mario Saavedra. Tune in right here tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. They'll have the latest in the political world, given that there was a big primary happening in New Hampshire this week. We'll break that down on Left, Right, and Center tomorrow at noon and 7 right here on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I will be back with you again on Monday.